nothing much happens in the life of a monk, except for Friday nights, which is always good fun. And the topic for this evening's talk, I was trying to avoid this topic as much as I could, but our admin officer, Dimi, has told me, she said, people have been emailing her and calling her up from overseas and from in Perth saying, Ajahn Brahm, please help. You have to give us some advice. Donald Trump. So first of all, to get this out of the way, the Donald Trump joke. In a school, a high school in the United States on a Friday afternoon, the teacher was doing a class in ethics and English and their culture. So she made the announcements in the high school. I'm going to give a little examination, a test on famous quotations. And if you get the answer right, you can leave school an hour early on Friday. You don't have to come back till Monday. That's the prize. So the first question, class, who said, I have a dream? And before she could go even to the next sentence, Ahmed in the back put his hand up and said, that was Martin Luther King. And the teacher said, wow, amazing, little Islam boy, Ahmed, very good, correct, you can go home. And the next question is, who said, it's not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country? And Yasmin, in a hijab, put her hand up and said, that was JFK, John F. Kennedy, miss. Correct. You can go home too. And as she was opening the door for little Yasmin to go out, this American kid in the back said, bloody Muslims. And the teacher turned around and said, who said that? And this American man said, Donald Trump, see you on Monday. Okay, that's out of the way. Anyway, back to business. Now, one of the first thing I say, that why do people get so afraid when things like that happen? Because even though I don't follow politics, I'm a monk. Even though I know there's one thing which you should all remember about politicians. They never keep their promises. So everything he promised to do, he's not going to keep them. Isn't that the case with other politicians? But still, people can't stop getting afraid. And that is the main purpose of this talk, the main point of the talk this evening. Not just about one particular instance of mass hysteria, but just the whole idea of fear which has happened in our community and how sometimes that fear really goes way out of context and it creates people to do stupid things like some of my disciples, and if you're listening to this online, please don't be so stupid. They are people in the United States who are thinking now of migrating to Canada. That's a silly thing to do. I wouldn't advise that at all. You should migrate to Perth instead. You don't need to migrate anywhere. Because a lot of times what fear does, it exaggerates the truth. And why is it that people actually, as soon as they get into fear, and especially if it becomes like public fear, that we lose all sense of reason, all sense of what is appropriate, and we totally overreact. And I have done that myself. One of my favorite stories growing up as a monk in Thailand, and there was many things to be afraid of there. Every little thing which crawled or walked in the jungle would look at you as their dinner. We were food for so many animals in the jungle. Even the ants looked at my toes, which were bare because I didn't have any shoes, looked at my toes as just fat worms to bite and eat. but everything was out to eat you. So it was a dangerous place to live. And I often say snakes. There was hundreds of snakes in Thailand. And I was advised when I first went to that country, the advice I was given was there were 100 species of snake in Thailand. There's actually more than that, but this was just to get me understanding what the situation was. 100 species of snake in Thailand. 99 are venomous. They bite you and you are in big trouble. The other one, the 100th one, strangles you to death. In other words, they were all really dangerous. But they were all over the place. And after a while, I learned what fear actually does. Because on this occasion, I was meditating in the jungle. Now, this was 40 years ago, you know, when there was a lot of jungle in Thailand, and there's many, many wild animals there. And of course, you know, they were very, very dangerous. People said to me, they told me, wild animals in Thailand don't attack monks. There's been no cases known of a tiger eating a monk or a bear sort of molesting a monk. And I said, of course there won't be. The monk wouldn't survive to let you know what happened, would he? There would be no evidence left. So it never reassured me at all. And in fact, some animals did attack monks. So, I was meditating in the jungle. Really dark. No lights. Had a sort of flashlight, but it was, you know, had to conserve the power. And there was no mobile phones. No one to call if there was any danger there. Deep in the jungle, alone, meditating. Now the jungle can be really peaceful at first, especially, you know, when the cicadas, you know, start to die down after sunset. It'd be very peaceful and very cool. You know, Thailand's a very hot country, but in the forest, the shade of the trees, maybe just the oxygen which they give up, gives a beautiful atmosphere. It's really cool and very peaceful and so secluded, hardly any disturbances at all. So I was getting into some really nice deep meditation. Until I heard a sound. There's always something in the jungle crawling around. And so I was mindful. As you know, I've been practicing this for years. I was very mindful. I didn't need to open my eyes. If I did, I couldn't see anything. It was pitch dark. I just listened and assessed. I was brought up as a scientist in Cambridge University. So I did some like assessment, gather some data, and use some reason. And by the sound of this animal, it was only just, you know, not really crushing leaves, it was just a little bit of rustling in the leaves. So I assessed it and said, oh, it's only maybe a small little animal, just, you know, walking through the jungle, nothing to be afraid of. So then I started meditating again. But then after another couple of minutes, I realized it was coming much closer. And as it was closer, I could hear it more clearly. And I realized, no, this is not a small animal, it's a medium-sized one. You could tell by the way it was actually crushing the leaves and breaking the twigs. But still, nothing to be really afraid of. And then when it got really close, wow, that's not a medium-sized one, that's a big one. Because the way it was making a noise, it must be something really heavy to actually to break, not twigs, but like almost like small branches. And crushing the leaves on the forest floor. Because you can't walk in the forest without any noise. There's too much undergrowth and too much leaves litter on the ground. This was a big animal. That was dangerous. And I got really scared. And I picked up my flashlight. And, you know, the waste of time for that really was a tiger. They just tell you the tiger where you were. But, you know, that's how stupid you are. You pick up your flashlight and you look for it. Where's the big tiger? And then I saw it. I saw it, just not that far in front of me. This tiny mouse, about this big, that's what it was. And that tiny mouse had been making a small noise, but it was my fear which had exaggerated that sound into thinking it really was a tiger. It's amazing what fear can actually do to you. Number one, it exaggerates the problem. So what is only a tiny little mouse becomes in the mind of a scientist meditator who's supposed to be wise and mindful, becomes like a huge tiger. That's what fear does. It exaggerates. So when I learned that, I realized, oh, come on, stop exaggerating what might go wrong. Because in my life, there's been many things to be afraid of. In Thailand, malaria. Malaria is a really bad, I know some people with malaria. Some people died of malaria. Very debilitating. And so a mosquito would come on your hand. I'm a monk, I'm not allowed to squash it, even though you wanted to. You know what I did sometimes when mosquitoes came up? I was very compassionate and kind to it. I just, with my little nail, just very gently moved it on. Go somewhere else. I thought I was being compassionate and kind, not really squashing. I could have done damage to that mosquito, but I just moved it gently. You know what that mosquito did? It just walked a few steps and bit me somewhere else. Those mosquitoes have got no respect. You think that being Thai mosquitoes, they'd respect monks, but they don't at all. So that was a waste of time. But then, of course, you started getting afraid. Maybe that mosquito's got malaria. Maybe I'm going to die of malaria. I'm going to be very sick. Ah! Until you realize there's only a tiny fraction of mosquitoes carry malaria. Tiny. Your chances of getting malaria from one of those mosquito bites is like the chance of winning the lottery. Absolutely zero. But fear meant, oh, well, yeah, that's fair enough. Maybe only in one in a million, but maybe that is that one in the million on my head now. That's what fear did, made you totally overreact. Number two is when you don't have the fear, you can really relax. And you find that things are amazing, that they don't go wrong. I was remembering somebody asked me when I first started teaching meditation. You know, when I first started teaching meditation was almost 43, 44 years ago when I was still a layperson. I was a high school teacher for 1 year. And I often say to, you know, many high school teachers actually come here. Teaching in a high school in UK for 1 year was the reason I became a monk. Anyone would think of leaving the world when you're faced with a bunch of teenagers all day. Really stressful. I think that's where I lost my hair. I'm only joking, I enjoyed myself there. But this was an old-fashioned English high school, and they had assembly every morning. And at assembly, you know, the headmaster, the principal read out a few announcements. But one of the teachers, one of the staff, and that was me this week, had to take the morning assembly. And it was mostly reading out Christian stuff. But I wasn't a Christian, I was a Buddhist. So I asked the principal, if I give the assembly for the week, can I teach meditation? And he said, well, what's meditation? I gave him a quick idea. He said, okay, why not? Give it a try. So I got on the stage there with, these were 11 to 17, 18 year olds, 650 of them. And I went up there and I said, okay, now be quiet, close your eyes, and straighten your backs, put your right hand over your left hand, and watch your breath go in, watch your breath go out. And you know, they all did that, only for 5 minutes. And it was only afterwards one of the teachers said, what would have happened, you know, in one of the senior teachers, because I was just a rookie, I just started, what would have happened if one of those kids started laughing? And you know, I never even thought about that. Because if one kid had started laughing, the whole 650 would have laughed and had broken the spell, and I'd have been embarrassed in front of the whole class, lost my authority, the whole school lost my authority. You know, if I'd have been afraid that might happen, it probably would have happened. Because I didn't even think about it, I wasn't afraid at all. I went up there with total confidence, never realizing, mostly because of my stupidity, you know, what kids are like, then that never entered my mind, and it never happened. And now I got a round of applause from those kids, you know, afterwards. for some reason, these were ordinary kids in UK. They appreciated 5 minutes apiece. This was way, way before mindfulness was even understood in the West, and that was 43 years ago in a high school in UK. So it's amazing. And a little extra about that, must have been about 25 years later, you know, just I was giving a talk somewhere in that area. I know these guys come up to you and they say, "Do you remember me?" Don't do that to me, please. Now, thousands of people, literally, honestly, thousands of people I see because I travel all over the world. And sometimes, you know, you see me on YouTube, but I don't see you, so I don't know who you are. And that it's really rude when somebody comes up to you and say, "Do you remember me?" And because I'm a monk, I have to be honest. And I, you know, say, "No, I haven't got a clue who you are." It's been embarrassing. So anyway, this person came up, and actually I had a little trick which I learned somewhere. It's a nice thing when somebody comes up to you and they say, "Do you remember me?" A nice reply, instead of saying no, which is really rude, say, "Oh yeah, you're that person whose name I keep forgetting." Which is a nice reply. "You're that person whose name I keep forgetting," which doesn't offend them. But you're being honest. But anyway, so I told this person, "I haven't got a clue who you were." He said, "I was one of those kids you taught meditation to." And now he was, he said it changed his whole life. Little things like that, which to me just, you know, you pass over. He said now he's devoting his life to teaching spirituality in education. That was really cool. Tiny little thing changes a lot of people, but it only worked because I had no fear. And I've often noticed if I'm afraid of something, of course then it doesn't work. But when I have no fear and you have the confidence, that's one of the reasons why I can tell jokes. Because I've got no fear if you don't understand it, which you often don't. So here comes today's real joke, not the Trump joke. Because I promised I'll tell this. This is actually a proper joke, a meditation joke. This is a Buddhist joke. So, you know, maybe please excuse me for this one. So this was, because last week, you may remember, I just came here very quickly. I was teaching a meditation retreat over in Jhana Grove. It just finished on Sunday. So this is what happened after one of my meditation retreats. You know, you get so peaceful and so cool. You know, you're so peaceful that you can't even walk fast and you can't talk fast. So one of my students, he went to work on a Monday morning, and his boss realized this was a very difficult person to actually have as your to work for you, because he was speaking so slowly. But fortunately, his job was actually working in Perth Zoo. So the head keeper there said, "What can I do with this guy? Just come off a retreat." And he said, "I've got a very good job for you. This morning, you can look after the tortoise enclosure." "Yes, I will look after the tortoises." And he walked very slowly, because you can't do things fast after a lot of deep meditation. Walked really slowly to the tortoise enclosure. Much slower than that, but you know, you get bored, you walk out if I keep on like this too long. So, at lunchtime, the head keeper decided to check up on him, how he was. He went to the tortoise enclosure. You know what? The gate was open, and all the tortoises had escaped. He said, "What happened?" And the man said, "Well, I opened the gate and whoosh." Because when you're in deep meditation, even tortoises go whoosh. It's all relative. Anyway, you know you're getting peaceful in meditation when tortoises run much faster than you can. So anyway, back to the thing about fear. Is why is I think that's a very funny joke, sorry. So When we talk about fear, one of the things is it destroys our present moment. Instead of enjoying, you know, the peace, the happiness of what we have now, we sacrifice all that because we're afraid of what might happen next. And I've done that too often in my life. And you find out what happens next doesn't happen. I was born just after the Second World War, and that was when we had nuclear bombs. And everyone thought there was going to be a huge war, a nuclear holocaust between the Soviet Union and United States. We're all going to get blown up. And at that time, I read somewhere that miso soup is makes you impenetrable to radiation. So I was really into the miso soup. Didn't like it, but you know, it's just to save you from the nuclear holocaust coming. And what happened? Nothing. It didn't happen. And then we had all sorts of other problems which were going to happen in our world. Oh yeah, I was in. Oh, actually, this was actually quite true, because there was this famous monk close by, and there's always amazing monks which I met. This monk, and I don't doubt this story, he became famous. This was in the north of Thailand, because a fighter jet pilot in the Thai Air Force. Oh, okay, that's not much of a siren. You can do better than that. Anyway, this Thai Air Force guy was flying, you know, I don't know how many 100,000 feet through the clouds, and he was really amazed because sitting on one of the clouds was a monk. He caught the monk levitating. Now, we're supposed to be doing that privately, but, you know, without getting caught, but, you know, because he didn't expect to see a fighter jet pilot up there, quiet place above the jungle, he got caught out. And so the fighter jet pilot could recognize him. You don't often see unidentified flying monks at 30,000 feet, and there was one. So he recognized the face, and he knew the location, the coordinates. And so when he landed, when he had a day off, he went looking for the unidentified flying monk, and found him exactly as he saw him in the the crowd. It looked exactly the same, and that's where he got very famous. And this monk, when I was up in that area, he said it's going to be the biggest fireworks day ever this year, and that meant nuclear holocaust. So I was told this by one of the monks, you better meditate really well, because this is your last chance. And it never happened. I was really disappointed with that monk. But nevertheless, so much. The other thing was, again, in Vietnam War, where I was stationed, you know, in the northeast of Thailand, it was twice the distance to Bangkok as it was to Hanoi. It was really, really close. And even the local embassies, they all had their evacuation plans for people like me. I had to register to evacuate in case the enemy invaded. And so I had everything packed at a moment's notice in case the Viet Cong came over the border and attacked, because they look at me straight away and think, CIA. Well, what happened? Nothing. All that worry and nothing ever happened. And I had learned from experiences like that how much fear of the future, where we don't know what's going to happen. It could have happened, but it never did. And how much that fear, projecting the worst possibilities for the future, destroyed my peace and happiness. I couldn't enjoy the present moment when I was afraid of something else. And from those days on, I always knew just the danger of fear. It stops you enjoying, you know, the day we have today, when we're afraid of what might happen tomorrow. And most of the time, it doesn't happen. Like, do some statistics. It was one of the other big experiences. You know, I go overseas to give lots of talks. Once I was going overseas to Singapore, I was becoming famous, and they decided to hold a big series of talks, 4 nights in a row at the convention center, 4,000 or 5,000 seats every evening, 4 nights in a row. That's even like bigger than Lady Gaga. And in order to get some seats sold, they did advertising on the buses. And I've got pictures of them, of me being advertised on the back of a bus in Singapore. And I remembered being told as a young man by people who didn't like me, said, "Brahm, you've got the face like the back of a bus." And now it was absolutely true. I actually saw it. So imagine how much that would cost to get advertising like that. And when I arrived at Singapore for this series of 4 talks, big problem. SARS. This was the height of the outbreak, the very middle, when that day the government had asked, please no public meetings. All the schools had been closed. And I read on the aircraft, on the paper, Straits Times, going in black, 99 cases of SARS had been diagnosed in Singapore. And it was on black, big black numbers, 99. And as I got out from the customs, to all the people who were organizing this, they were all so worried and scared. And they asked, "Shall we cancel? Shall we cancel?" And I said, "Look, I just read 99 people have SARS. How many people live in Singapore?" I said, "About 4 million. "Well," I said, "that means 3,999,901 people do not have SARS. So that's about 40,000 to one. So I'm in for those odds." So I said, "Let's go ahead." So when you actually put it in the other context, not, you know, how many people had that disease, but how many people didn't, that gave it perspective and took away all their fear. And I did mention to them, "Look, what is SARS anyway? Sudden acute respiratory system. It affects your lungs, and it only affects those people whose lungs are weak. So I am going to tell lots and lots and lots of jokes in those 4 days, because when I get people laughing, that will strengthen their lungs, which will make them more immune to SARS. So I'm actually helping." When I put it like that, they laughed too. And we went ahead, and no one got SARS. It's amazing, just, you know, the first time only a couple of thousand people came because they thought we weren't going to do it, and then 3,000, the word got around, and the full house the last day. Amazing. Because fear stops you benefiting from what's happening right now. You can't enjoy the present moment and afraid what's going to happen next. Fear actually destroys the present moment, and it also destroys the future. Because what you're afraid of, you usually make happen. Often I talk to people because, you know, you have relationships. Relationships are a big thing in your life. I know sometimes people are so afraid the relationship's going to go wrong. So what do? They get so tense. They can't enjoy the present moment because they're wondering, "Oh, maybe it won't last. Maybe he'll find somebody else. Maybe, you know, she'll go out with somebody else." Which makes you so tense. You can't relax and enjoy each other's company. Which means what you're afraid of actually happens. You know, you actually do split up, because who wants to be with somebody like that who can't enjoy themselves because we're so damn afraid? Afraid of losing your job. If you're afraid of losing your job and you think about that all day, you're not productive, so you lose your job. That's what happens. So a lot of times it is the fear is the enemy, not what you're afraid of. So when it comes to United States, Donald Trump, I don't know what's going to happen. But what I do know, it will always be things which I don't expect. That is one thing which I learned. The future is totally uncertain, unpredictable. No one could actually predict he was going to win, and he did win. Now everyone's predicting all the terrible things which are going to happen, and I can actually pretty much predict that they won't. What you're afraid of doesn't happen. It's usually something much worse. No, it's not. Life goes on. So, what can we do? And this is where we go back to simple Buddhism, the law of karma. Now, people think, why does this happen? This must be some bad karma. People in the United States have made bad karma. They get a bad president. If he's a bad president, I don't know. But what about us? We're going to have to be affected by this. What karma did we do? Look, that's not how we look at karma in Buddhism. Karma gives you the ingredients. What we do with those ingredients, that is real karma, the karma of now. The other is the karma of the past. The old story, which I haven't found a better story, is in Opening the Door of Your Heart, one of the books which I wrote. It describes this. The best simile I've got, two people baking a cake. The first person baking the cake has got the very worst ingredients. They got white flour, which is so old, it's got green moldy bits in it. I remember flour like that when I was a student. We couldn't afford anything, so you know, we'd have to take the green bits out and use the other bits. White moldy flour, diabetically enhanced sugar, cholesterol enhanced butter, and whatever fruit you can get, you know, to put in there, and just an old kitchen to cook it in. The very worst ingredients, but the second person has got the very best ingredients. Organically grown whole wheat flour, gluten-free. It's sown in a field where there has been no genetically modified crops for 1,000 kilometers surrounding. A free-range wheat, that is. Sorry, I don't know what I'm talking about. I sometimes read this on the, you know, the stuff which I see, and I don't know what it means. But anyway, and canola oil, which is people, I'm not sure if it's just true or not. It's supposed to be cholesterol free. Beautiful honey from Western Australia, and fresh fruit from their back garden. And the very best of ingredients, and the most modern kitchen to cook it in. So those are the two people. Who bakes the best cake? And this is actually where you understand what karma is. Who bakes the best cake? It's not always the person with the best ingredients. It's not always that. You go to Asia, Penang. Where do you get the best food? In the restaurants? In the streets, yeah. The hawkers. They can't afford the best ingredients or the best kitchen. But the competition is so cutthroat that they have to make the best to survive. They have to put so much more effort, energy, love and skill into their cooking. They have to, otherwise they won't survive. And that's why their cooking is much more delicious. Now that is like, you know, what the law of karma. It's not just the ingredients you have to work with. The most important part of karma is what you're doing with those ingredients, how you're putting them together, the amount of effort and energy and love, whatever you have. So to all the people in the United States, yes, Mr. Trump is going to give you some ingredients, but what's really important is how you're going to put those things together, what you're going to do with them, and that is your responsibility. So you're no longer a victim, you're no longer disempowered by what happens in a big political field, or with wars, or with other disasters which come into this planet. That is not the most important part. It's what you're going to do with what you've got. Oh, you know, just what comes to mind, disasters. I always remember the tsunami, because actually I was in Penang when the tsunami hit. I remember this story, it was really interesting, because I was, you know, the head monk, the number two monk at the time, was trying to contact me. Heard that tsunami had hit Penang and a few people had died, and was really concerned. Ajahn Brahm, how are you? How are you? And eventually got through to me, found out there's no problem at all. And He was so relieved. And I said, "What are you really worried about?" And he said, "Well, actually, not really worried about you, but worried that if you died, I'd have to be the abbot." And that's what I was worried about. I didn't want to take over and work so hard. But seeing that, there was a terrible thing which happened, but lots of beautiful things happened as a result of that. There's always some good happens from disasters. And that's the thing which I always like to look at. Recently, that I did see in newspapers, there was the anniversary of the Great Fire of London, I think 250 years or something. 350 years? No, it must be 350 years as well. 660, yeah, 350 years or something. And that Great Fire of London destroyed just a whole of maybe 80% of the town of London. But what happened afterwards, the architects and the engineers had this clear land to make our modern city of London. And one of the things they did there, which I remember reading, which was so brilliant, now they had the chance to put it in a proper sewage system. And that sewage system is still there to this day, because it's so hard to put a sewage system in when you've got to dig under people's houses and properties. They won't let you in. But now they can put the big sewage system in and then let people build on top of it. And that's one of the reasons why that Great Fire of London was an enormous opportunity. So disasters, whenever they happen, not to be afraid of. These are the ingredients which you have. And stop being afraid of these things. Oh, it's terrible, it's going to be bad. No, what are you doing about it? And that's also in people's lives. So many people here are afraid of cancer. Maybe you've got cancer. Why are you afraid of it? If you're afraid of it, it actually brings it on. I think I told a story a few weeks ago, but I always go to the Cancer Wellness Association over in Cottesloe. I'm well known over there. I go there once a year. They come to monastery once a year. And just last year when they built a huge complex there, a new campus, they call it, in Railway Parade in Cottesloe, having the big opening, and the Premier was the first VIP. Guess who the second VIP was? Ajahn Brahm! And I said, "Why are you inviting me?" Well, it's not the archbishops, you know, no rabbis, no movie stars, no Hugh Jackmans or any models or anything, just Ajahn Brahm. Why? And it's because they told me that I've been going to that place for over 26 years and always being of service to them, and they really value me there. So much so, and I said, "Well, why?" And that's when they told me, the very first time I went there, I talked about fear and how to overcome it. And that had a huge impact on the people who attend that place. Because what happened, there was one woman there, she had been through cancer, in remission, but there was a problem. Her problem was, what happens if it comes back again? And she was so terrified of that. That was her fear. And you can understand, you know, if you've been through a cancer, all that treatment, which is really harsh, and you beat it, but can I do this again? And so that was her fear, what would happen if it happens again? But I came along, apparently that no one else could actually solve that problem, answer that question, until I came along and I answered a question for her. And the question was, you know, what happens if it comes back? And I told her, what happens if it won't come back? If it doesn't come back at all, then what? And this woman actually got it straight away. Yeah, I never thought of that. I was always so afraid of it coming back. I never even thought of what might happen if it never comes back. And it never came back. But she comes back every year to see me. Now that is fear. You can understand when you're afraid, what happens if it comes back? It's going to come back. You're actually creating the conditions, the stress, which causes those cancers. And all you need to do is to change the perception. What happens if it doesn't come back? Fear is looking at the future with a negative mind. So, people are afraid of Donald Trump. You're looking at the future with a negative mind. I don't know what's going to happen. Whatever happens, I'm sure you can deal with it. That's karma. You can make something happen with whatever happens, whatever you get. Make something out of it. And don't be afraid. Don't get negative. A country is not one person. A world is not one person. It's us. And sometimes I think that disempowerment is one of the things which people, they just give up too easily or accept too easily. You have the power to do things. Government doesn't control that much of your life, really. This is not North Korea. You have a lot of freedoms there, a lot of opportunities. So never ever feel a victim, think, ugh, it's going to be terrible, it's going to be awful, what am I going to do? No, there's always something great you can do. Always light a candle rather than complain about darkness. It's one of my guiding principles in life. Don't complain about darkness, light a candle. Something's black in the future, light something. Make it more hopeful, more positive. And when we have that positive mind, instead of getting so negative, United States is going down, it's going to affect us, the economy is going to... Yeah, that's what the media like writing about. I will never get an article published in the media, because I go along and say, oh, it doesn't matter, everything's all right. What would happen if it does work out okay? You know, no one likes to read that. We always want to read about the terrible things which might happen, the nasty stuff which is going on. Why? Why are people just so inclining towards negativity? And why it's just such a hard thing to accept that these negative things probably will never happen, that most people do not get cancer. I'm going to finish off, open up for questions, with a cartoon which really impressed me last year. I get a lot of my wisdom from cartoons. If you want to know philosophy, just go and look at cartoons. You get much better understanding of what's going on in the world and also about philosophy from cartoons. And this was a Peanuts cartoon. And there was Charlie Brown and his dog Snoopy. I don't know why in cartoons, but the animals are always much smarter than humans. Maybe there's something to that in real life. Look at dogs. Dogs never have to worry about going to work on a Monday morning. You do. Dogs don't have to worry about, you know, getting a place to stay. You know, they just really enjoy themselves. Dogs don't have to worry about food. They get so much. So dogs, they're really smart, aren't they? You have to work for them. Anyway, so there was Charlie Brown and his dog Snoopy. And Charlie Brown, sort of, you know, becoming a bit philosophical, he says, you know, one day we will all die. It's true, isn't it? But it's so negative. One day we will all die. You think, ooh, I'm going to die, that's terrible. I don't want to die, I've got so much to do. And people start having these bucket lists. They're crazy. So kick the bucket list is my answer to that. Anyway, so one day we will all die, says Charlie Brown. And Snoopy replies with Buddhist wisdom. That dog is a Buddhist, in my mind. At least he deserves to be a Buddhist by what he said next. Charlie Brown, yes. One day we will all die. And Snoopy said, most days we will all not die. And that's true, isn't it? How many days have you got in your life? 365 times 70, someone could do that calculation on your little iPhone for me if you wish. So many days in our life, you know, most of those days, you don't die. It's only one of those days you die. You understand? That is negativity. One day we will die. Oh, one day you're going to leave me. Oh, one day things are going to go wrong. Oh, Mr. Trump is going to mess up the world. But most days he's not going to. Remember that and you'll be happy. Thank you for listening. Very good. Okay, so now we've got some questions. Probably the first one is from Trump Tower. Big trouble again. Here we go. We've got two questions from here. Sandy Clark from Malaysia, is fear completely useless or can it serve as some benefit? Does it not help to be prepared rather than caught off guard? The reason I talk like I do today is because our fear is too strong, dominates us too much. So let's lessen the fear. We're way over the top in fear. People who've got no fear at all or are stupid, you know, go down on a motorbike at 120 kilometers an hour without any crash helmet. Now that is stupid. But for most people, our fear is far too strong and dominates our lives and stops us being happy and reasonable. So I'm just trying to move the fear to what is a proper level. Next one, we seem to be living in a society in which fear is encouraged when something we care about is at stake. How do we make peace with uncertainty and develop gratitude for what we do have, despite the transient nature of things? Indeed, it's a good question. Fear is encouraged when something we care about is at stake. We care about the wrong things. We should care about peace. Our peace is at stake. Our happiness, our freedom is at stake. Care for that. And then we will get rid of a lot of our fears. So, it's uncertain, but we have a certain amount, the outside is uncertain, but we have a certain amount of responsibility and control about how we deal with the uncertainties of life. We can always make peace with them and be kind to them and learn from them, grow from them. See, uncertainties of life is where we learn and grow in compassion and peace. That's how we deal, but not with fear. Fear stunts growth. Look at those people in education. If your kid is really afraid of the teacher, you can't learn much at all. If they're afraid of experimenting, learning, there's no innovation at all. My monks, if they're afraid of making mistakes and getting punished, they would never be able to survive as monks. Of course we make mistakes. That's where we learn and grow. So for goodness sake, don't be afraid. And lastly, never be afraid of what people think of you. If you're afraid of what people think of you, have a look at me, traveling around the world, dressed like a girl, with a bald head. Actually, bald head is actually quite cool these days. Many people have bald heads. I'm getting really disappointed because in the old days, being a bald was actually quite unique. Now it's taking off. Maybe I should grow some hair to be unique. But anyhow, that's where the uncertainty of life is. We should care for the right things. The things we should care about is peace and happiness and joy, living life in the present moment and not worrying too much about the future, and also the friendship which we have towards one another. Care about those really important things. And those are some things which prime ministers and presidents got no control over. You can always be kind. You can always forgive. You can always smile and laugh at people, no matter who they are. They may not be able to understand your speech because they come from a different country, speak a different language. But everybody knows how to laugh. And you smile at a person from a different religion, different country, different race. You smile at them, and they always smile back. Okay. So any questions from the audience here? On fear and politics and everything. Okay, great. So let's pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and then you can come and line up and ask your questions.